today we're carrying on with really what has been a theme over the last 2 months, and that is not asking for why things are happening, but asking people to look forward. And our subject today is 5 years after the Arab Spring, prospects for the Middle East. And I'm very interested to see whether we get a consistent approach from our three very distinguished speakers as to what is likely to happen. If I can introduce them now, then I'll ask them each to speak in turn for about 10 minutes, and after that I'll open it to the floor as usual, finishing on the dot of 2 o'clock, which is, as you know, my practice. Firstly, on my right, Alistair Crook is the director and founder of Conflicts Forum. He was formerly advisor on the Middle East to Javier Solana, the EU foreign policy chief. He was also a staff member of Senator George Mitchell's fact-finding committee that inquired into the causes of the 2001 Intifada, and was an advisor to the International Quartet. He helped to arrange certain ceasefires in the occupied territories and the withdrawal of occupying forces on 2 occasions. He's had a lot of experience over the last 20 years working with Islamist groups, and has extensive experience working with movements such as Hamas, Hezbollah, and other Islamist movements in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the rest of the Middle East. So he's highly qualified to speak to us today. He wrote in 2009 a book called Resistance, The Essence of the Islamist Revolution, and I do recommend that to you. On my left, Jane Kinnenment is a senior research fellow and deputy head of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. Her previous positions include associate director for the Middle East and Africa at The Economist Group, Middle East and North Africa editor and economist at The Economist Intelligence Unit from 2006 to 2010, and managing editor for Middle East and Africa at Business Monitor before that. And she contributes regularly to the media, including The Economist, The Guardian, and Foreign Policy. And again, I think we're very lucky to have her with us today. And on my far left, Tariq Osman, a political economist focused on the Arab world. He's the author of the internationally acclaimed book, Egypt on the Brink. He's a regular contributor to Foreign Affairs, the Financial Times, and the Cairo Review. And he's a writer and presenter of the BBC's major production, The Making of the Modern Arab World. His new book, Islamism, What It Means for the Middle East and the World, has just been published. He has got copies here today, priced at £15 each, and if any of you want to buy one after you've heard him, please do so, and I'm sure he'd be happy to sign one for you. But as I say, the subject is 5 years after the Arab Spring. It hardly feels like that, but it is. The prospects for the Middle East. Alistair Crook. Could you do it from there so they can see you here at the back?
Maybe.
That's an awful thing to ask.
Yeah.
We always have problems with people at the back hearing, so...
I'm not so good standing up, but I shall try. Michael, thank you very much. I think, however, that to a certain extent, to look forward, you also have to just cast a glance backwards. So be assured I will look forward. But first of all, we really have to look a little bit at, you know, what are we dealing with? Because I think this still remains uncertain. Was the Arab Spring really the apotheosis of Western values arising in the Middle East, as the narrative has had it? Certainly there was in the Middle East, and there still is, an important constituency that would like to subsume the Middle East into the Western financial sphere. But I think that this is only part of the story, and a very partial understanding of what happened. We have argued, that is my organization, and we argued from the outset, in fact, that what we were seeing in the Arab Spring was the confluence of three really quite long-term dynamics. Dynamics that had existed well before 2011, but were very much shaping the process. First of which was really the sense that we were seeing a marked stage in the decomposition of what I would describe as the Arab system. What do I mean by the Arab system? I mean that this was the process by which the elites of the Ottoman era, the Ottoman elites, were translated and taken over by Messrs. Sykes and Picot into the new states which the powers were constructing at the time, as the rulers, the emirs and kings of the new region. when this happened, of course, there was no sense of a social contract between rulers and the ruled, and so it was very much a security states that were formed in that First World War period. And this was the sense that what was happening and the reaction that we saw in 2011 was the sense of the discrediting, the collapse of legitimacy, the collapse of credibility of the old Arab system. I think to a certain extent one can say that the fall, the failure of the peace process partly stripped away the last fig leaf which gave the Arab system some sense of meaning or for its existence. I think, although, as we have seen, they were discredited, of course they were not impotent, and what they became was, in fact, the counter-revolution. I think the second long-term trend that we saw, the dynamic that we saw in the beginning of 2011, was also the behind the popular protest, the reddit Islamist movements. The Islamist movements of the various hues who were preparing and preparing for the future. What they were preparing, I suggest, was not so much a reform movement, but this was a power game, essentially. It was about power, and behind each of those Islamist movements, of course, stood states. Whether it was Saudi Arabia or Qatar or it was Turkey, behind the Islamist movements were states, and states with their own interests. I think the third element was that at the time, by 2011-2012, nearly all the elements of the Sunni idea of governance, the Egyptian model, the Muslim Brotherhood model, the Gulf model, the Egyptian model, all of these too were discredited. So not only the elites were losing their legitimacy and crumbling, but also the models were losing their legitimacy. And of course, this process of fragmentation, erosion of institutions and structures, was taking place precisely at the time when we saw Iran becoming resurgent. Iran clearly was going through a process of resurgency at this time. But I do not think that it is therefore possible really to say that the friction that has arisen between the Gulf states and the Sunni world and Iran is solely due, if you like, to the actions of Iran or the resurgence of Iran. It's true that in a way the Sunni world was coming apart, identities collapsing, structures eroding. At the same time, Iran, if I may say, was coming together, and that increased the friction between the two. But I don't think you can therefore say that Iran is either wholly or generally responsible for the increase of friction and the crisis that took place within the Sunni world at that time. Of course, Sunnis felt this very deeply, and they felt, if you like, the usurpation of their role, the inherited prerogatives that had come, if you like, from their past. They were the state. Sunnis were the majority, are the majority. They were of the state, part of the state. And the whole Ottoman experience had rooted in many Sunnis the sense of that they were the state and that they were responsible for the state, and that somehow all of this, both prerogatives and the idea of statehood, was slipping away from the Sunni grasp. So we had a very strong Sunni reaction. A reaction to this, and I think in terms of that reaction, if you like, a counter-revolution, of course, Iran was a useful distraction too. And of course, the old Sunni Arab system may have been eroding in terms of its legitimacy, but at that stage still had a cash. I don't think any of those dynamics have yet worked themselves out. I think all of those dynamics of the weakness of the Arab system, Islamist movements as power games more than reformist movements, and the sense of the failure of models of governance and statehood have gone. I think when we then look at the sort of balance sheet and try and see, you know, what has happened in this period, has there been then some sort of revolution? Was there a revolution? I think one would have to say, in a sense, that there was a revolution indeed, but not quite the one that we generally assume. The revolution that I have seen living in that region during that period has actually been a Salafist revolution rather than a liberal democratic revolution. 30 years ago, I saw Salafism embedded itself in the northern areas of Pakistan, parts of Afghanistan, parts of India in terms of Deobandism. And now we see, if you like, Salafism spreading across the western lands of Islam and into North Africa. It is now deeply entrenched in North Africa. And it is reflected and supported by a further dynamic, which I think is equally important. When I talk about Salafism, I don't mean it simply as a political event. I'm talking about it as a cultural, as an educational, as a media process that is very powerful. There are some 67 Salafist 24-hour television stations broadcasting across the Middle East, which are watched by many Arab women in the region, and innumerable radio stations too. So yes, there has been, if you like, some form of a revolution, but I think the revolution that we're witnessing has been essentially a Salafist one, which has got cultural, media, all sorts of dimensions to it, as well as an ideological one. We have also seen during these years, and I believe starting in the 1920s, that Sunni Islamism has been tipping further and further towards literalism and what I would call exteriority. In other words, outward signs of Islam rather than inward signs of Islam. In the way of dress, in obvious public, if you like, displays of piety, and in that way. And now we have seen finally that one part of the Islamic world has tipped right over into what can only be described as extreme literalism, ISIS. An extreme form of Puritanism and literalism, which is ISIS. I don't think that we are going to see the end of ISIS. I think it is quite possible that ISIS will be defeated in Syria and possibly in Iraq. But ISIS essentially does represent an element which has always been in Islam. Never a majority orientation within Islam, but always been present, sometimes latent in Islam, going back, if you like, to the Mongol Revolution, going back, if you like, to the 18th century when Islam saw the defeat of the Ottoman Empire at the gates of Vienna. It was a sense of when there is a crisis, Islam has turned back to this orientation in terms of people like Ibn Taymiyyah and Muhammad Abdul Wahhab, and who are advocating and see the need to clean the Arab system, to remove it and to cleanse it by fire, if necessary. And I think that what you are seeing and what you will see, even if it is defeated, is not going to simply disappear as a orientation within Islam, because essentially it is a manifestation of crisis, of a lack of security and confidence that exists within the Sunni Islam at this time. Now, turning to the question, therefore, of the future, I think it was Harold Macmillan who was asked by a journalist what frightened him most in politics. And he replied very curtly, "Events, dear boy, events. Not only do they define the present, but they also change the present, and somehow they define the future and even the past as we all reconstruct our past narratives at the same time." So what do I predict will be the events that will now shape it, apart from those dynamics which I say are still present in the region? I think the first one that I would say that will, I think, affect people and will affect the region very much is that I don't think that Syria is going to be, as many suspect, quagmire, but rather it is going to be a military victory and a clear-cut victory. I think we in the West are not used to military victories. We're more used to seeing quagmires and perhaps rather expected. But I sense it's going to be a military victory. I think that this is going to be extremely hard for the West to swallow, the idea of a success by Mr. Putin and by Iran and Hezbollah in Syria. And I think that that is going to affect the next part of the events that are going to take place. And the second event, I would say, which is the expansion and the continuation of the 4+1 coalition as a security architecture. The Europeans are busily looking around for some sort of security architecture, including Saudi Arabia and Iran and other people. But actually, there is a security architecture that is already working and there and effective in place, albeit led by Russia and Iran. And I think that what we will see is its inclusion and its incorporation, if you like, in the Shanghai Cooperation defense structure, because China particularly, but also Russia, are extremely worried that Central Asia is as vulnerable to Wahhabism as Syria and Iraq have been, and that they do not want that. So that security will become, or Central Asia will become, a critical issue, and the experience of the 4+1 in Syria and Iraq will be crucial to the evolution of another one. The big question in all of this is, will the West become so, if you like, angered by Putin and Iranian success in Syria that they tend to regard this new security structure of the 4+1 as antagonistic, as being anti-Western, which it isn't. But it may well be the case that we will see a new polarization take place between the emerging security structures of Russia and Iran, both in Eurasia as a whole, if you like, not just Middle East, but Middle East and Asia, and that it will become a new polarization and a new source of tension, with the front line of NATO in Turkey and the front line of the 4+1, of course, being in Syria. Then finally, I would say the last one that I want to mention is another, if you like, event in the Harold Macmillan one that comes on to us and changes everything unexpectedly, and then we have to change all our narratives to explain it afterwards. But the event I'm talking about is not at all political, but is geofinancial. It is the collapse in the price of oil. It is also the collapse in the commodities. The whole of the MENA region is going to be affected by this incredibly. Oil is not just any commodity. Oil is so central to all of the Western economic structure. So many jobs are affected in it. So many other assets and fields of economic activity are also affected by oil. The collapse in the price of oil is going to bring about big changes. The collapse in the price of raw materials, when you see companies like Anglo American going to cut back by 80% in parts of Africa, and the revenues will collapse by a similar proportionate amount. What was it that kept these elites up in Africa and in the North Africa and in much of it? It was simply the money coming in from the international oil companies and from the commodity firms like Anglo American. But these prices, we are going to see many changes. These governments will be removed. There will be much change in terms of public distress, because not only are we seeing that, but we're seeing tourism drying up across the region as well. Countries like Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco are all being badly hit by that. So what is going to be the outcome of that? Well, I think the consequences for Europe are going to be manifold. At the moment in Europe, there are 16.8 million internally displaced people in the Middle East. This summer, we'll see some more. And yet, we may also see more surprises falling out of the sky over Manhattan and the Wall Street during the period ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alistair. I'm going to call Jane Kinnamont.
Thank you very much, and it's wonderful to have the chance to discuss with such a distinguished audience. I'm also going to start by looking backwards, just to touch on the issues that were the major drivers of the Arab Spring. I personally prefer the term Arab uprisings and would define what we're talking about here as being a series of interconnected uprisings and political mobilisations that varied from fully fledged uprisings that managed to unseat leaders in some cases to smaller scale instances of political mobilisation, which in some countries largely happened in a virtual space rather than on the streets. But I think it's useful to think of 2011 as a time when political mobilisation was increasing in virtually all countries of the Arab world. It wasn't a phenomenon limited to a few countries. And most of the causes or drivers that we can identify for that jump in mobilisation are still in place. They haven't been resolved either by governments that have gone through transitions or by ones that have turned to some blend of repression and reform. And the implication of that is that there is likely to be further unrest as different groups seek to compete for power with differing visions of political change. But these groups are going to be likely to be seeking new ways to express themselves and to compete for power rather than replicating the mass social movements that were seen in 2011. There's no single cause of these complex phenomena, but you had really a perfect storm in the region of demographics, famously with the Middle East being the second youngest region in the world after sub-Saharan Africa, and with a very large proportion of the population under 30, often rebelling against leaders who were more than twice their age and who had established their legitimacy in a different era. There are also various economic factors, because this young population, while potentially a great asset for the MENA region, has become increasingly well-educated but not increasingly well-employed. And so you've had a problem not just of youth unemployment, but of crushed expectations of unemployed graduates, often becoming leaders of protests because of disappointment. The IMF published an interesting study last year looking into sort of why many economists had failed to read the signs of dissent to come, because when they had looked at macroeconomic indicators of growth, growth seemed quite good. But there was very little that could capture the more subjective elements of dissatisfaction. And the IMF have noted that where you do look at public opinion surveys, which are less developed in the Middle East than in much of the world, then in the years leading up to the Arab Spring, you tended to have much higher rates of dissatisfaction with government services than in other regions of the world, and the levels of dissatisfaction tended to be rising. They also argued that conflict in the region had been particularly likely when economic inequalities appeared to be very pronounced between ethnic and sectarian groups, not just between classes. We could also see in certain countries, like in Tunisia and Egypt, there was a huge amount of mobilisation against inequality. And yet, by the Gini coefficient, an indicator of inequality, Tunisia in 2010 was as unequal as the US. But something else was at play in terms of how people interpreted that inequality, not as something that was natural or something that was just, but you saw various social and political movements arguing that inequality was due to corruption and that the least deserving were being rewarded the most and gaining the most from growth. You also saw in some countries, more than others, a long-term erosion of state capacity, and in countries that did see transitions, often a split within the government or a split between the ruler and the security forces became part of the dynamic that pushed popular mobilisation into actual political change. And the final factor is perhaps the least tangible, but is to do with information, beliefs and a sense of possibility. There was, for a moment in 2011, a critical mass gathering behind peaceful mass movements for change, which was largely undefined. The strength of those movements in 2011 was that they were cross-ideological, but that was also their weakness. You had groups uniting to push for change with no clear unified agenda of what should come next or how the policy problems that they rightly identified could translate into changes on the ground. Fast forward to today, basically all of these pressures still exist. The economic ones have become worse. And sadly, even in the country that has made the most political progress in terms of a formal political transition, Tunisia, where you have had a Muslim Brotherhood affiliated party not only voted into power but successfully voted out, the economy has been massively damaged by insecurity, uncertainty, and of course ISIS attacks. Generally speaking, growth in the oil importing countries of the Middle East has halved since 2011. So unemployment has been getting worse, and today there are fewer and fewer opportunities for people to migrate, of course, as Europe becomes more and more sceptical about both migrants and refugees. So the jobs problem, the frustrated expectations have got worse. The only factor in the Arab Spring that has really changed is the sense of a critical mass behind peaceful movements for democratic change. Many people who saw hope in 2011 have come to think that they were wrong, they were naive, they didn't, their expectations didn't match reality. And this is something that is cited often by the more stable governments in the region, as really people have learned the value of stability and they've realised that democracy is not for this part of the world. But the word of caution that I would note there is that while some people have basically gone into a more of a situation of apathy and acquiescence, there are still many people that are seeking political change, and without having peaceful routes, credible peaceful routes to go down, they are, a minority of them at least, are likely to turn to violent means. And we see this demonstrated very clearly, above all in Syria, where it has been after the extensive and brutal repression of the opposition that the opposition there has become increasingly radicalised and increasingly anti-Western in a way that was not the case at the beginning. We've also seen in Western policy quite a flip-flopping, not just over the past 5 years, but a little longer term. You'll recall after 9/11, there were many calls from the US in particular for a more democratic Middle East. And after the Iraq war, the election of Hamas in Palestine and so forth, Western countries generally backed away from the democracy agenda. But in 2011, this rose very high up the agenda again. Personally, I joined Chatham House 2 weeks after Mubarak had fallen. And I remember at that time many people from foreign ministries and from government strategy teams saying, nobody predicted the Arab Spring. This means there has to be a major revision of policy. We need to look hard at the assumptions that have underpinned our Middle East policies and come up with something new. 5 years on, that essentially hasn't happened. The Middle East has had so many crises that policy has largely been confined to a constant emergency response, with people being entirely focused on an emergency in Libya, then moving to Syria, looking at things in a very short-term way, which I think is something worth underlining at this strategy forum, as it may be interesting for us to discuss what might a more strategic response look like when the realities on the ground are shifting so fast and assumptions are having to be questioned all the time. Today, very few policymakers really look at the Middle East in terms of democratic development. Their focus is primarily on terrorism and on migration. After that, on conflict, with the very hot conflicts in Yemen, Syria and Libya, the highest up the agenda, leaving actually little time or bandwidth left to look into the potential for some of the simmering conflicts underneath the surface, perhaps above all in Egypt, to really be factored into policy making. But this short-termism does strike me as quite uninformed by a larger reading of comparative transitions and political development. We've seen in other regions of the world that democracy rarely is something that comes smoothly overnight, led by liberal Democrats. Even in the case of the UK, looking back to the time of the Magna Carta, this wasn't a group of nice liberal people thinking we should lay the foundations for the mother of all parliaments. This was essentially Barron saying, time for us to get a greater share of the power and make life harder for the king. Democracy usually emerges as some kind of messy compromise. And even if you look back to the period of revolutions and democratisation in parts of Eastern Europe, also those dynamics led to conflict, above all in the Balkans. A more strategic response to the Arab uprising should be looking longer term. It should be better informed by the experiences of elsewhere and not see the Arab countries as an entirely unique special case that are somehow immune from the wider sweep of world history. I'm out of time. I look forward to discussing more. Thank you.
Finally, I'm going to call Tariq Osman.
Thank you for the invitation and thank you for coming. I will not look backwards, so I'll look forward. And let me start by invoking the point that everybody made, and I think almost every article in the Middle East in the past few years made, that we are seeing a transformation in the Arab world, and I agree with that. Almost a century after Sykes-Picot, as Alistair mentioned, we are seeing effectively the order of the Middle East falling. And I think we are at a very interesting fork in the road. What I'll do in the next, hopefully, 10 minutes is to put in front of you two sets of forces that I think are taking this region in very different directions. The first force, or set of forces, I think are very destructive. So to invoke the obvious, I think the order that has existed in the Arab world, and especially in the Levant or the Eastern Mediterranean, has basically fallen. We're seeing that very clearly in the two countries that have some sort of historical depth, even if both of them are very new, and certainly demographic size, which are Iraq and Syria. Both of them really do not exist, and realistically will not exist for some time. So that's on the state order, if you'd like. Second force is that I think the idea also of a national state in the Eastern Mediterranean is really crumbling. And I don't know if there are many Lebanese experts here or not, but those who are following what's happening in Lebanon, or what has been happening in Lebanon since 2005, since the assassination of Hariri, probably would come to the conclusion that the idea of Riyadh al-Sulh and Bishara Khoury, which was also born at the time of the Sykes-Picot, of a secular state, despite the sectarianism of Lebanon, I think that idea is coming to an end right now. And I think many Lebanese also are coming to the conclusion of how can we survive together as sects as opposed to as Lebanese. What I'm trying to say here, I'm going to move in very fast, hopefully to be super fast, is that not just the idea of the nation state in the Eastern Mediterranean has fallen, but I think the idea of the secular national state has taken a huge blow, if you'd like, in the Arab world, especially in the Eastern Mediterranean. A third point to keep in mind, Alistair mentioned 16 million stateless people. I don't know the source of the number, but what I'm certain of is that at least in the Eastern Mediterranean right now, there are over 4 million Arabs who are not just stateless, but also they are homeless, basically. They are educationless, they are any kind of services less. So you take my bad English and interpret it, but basically they are all over the Eastern Mediterranean in very poor countries, specifically Lebanon and Jordan. And the interesting thing is that for probably the first time in at least a century, you have a generation of Arabs, again, especially in the Levant, who really don't know what the idea of a state is. They're very much within communities, within certainly sects, you name it, but not within a state, and that is applicable in many parts of Iraq, many parts of Syria, parts of Lebanon, certainly parts of Palestine, and that's also a very interesting force to look at. Another very sad force in the Arab world right now is violence. The Arab world has always been very violent, probably since the past 15 centuries, but I think the level of violence we've seen in the Arab world in the last 5 years is extremely high, especially that much of it was state-sponsored by states against its own people, basically, let alone groups. And that is an interesting point. The Arab state has lost its legitimacy, in my view, much earlier than 2011, much, much earlier than that. But I think the idea of that level of violence taking place in the Arab world in the last 5 years, much of it state-sponsored against its own people, I think takes the idea of the state-society relationship in the Arab world to new, frightening levels. It also shows us something very interesting. If you look at how groups, non-state actors, across the Arab world, not just Hezbollah in Lebanon, by the way, because that's the usual example that is invoked, in different parts of the Arab world, including in the Gulf, including in North Africa, many non-state actors are seeing themselves now not just as political forces, but they see themselves as with a mission to protect their own people. That is, to my mind, a very interesting fragmentation of, again, the state-society relationship. Also, the Arab state has become very interesting in the last few years. It is becoming very selective in who it bestows the citizenship on, which is very interesting in the Arab politics. Most of you, I'm sure, know Arab history extremely well. If you look at the model that emerged from days of anti-colonialism from 1920s, 30s, moving to Arab nationalism, Nasser, what have you, even during the 80s and 90s under the likes of Mubarak and Qaddafi and King Fahd and all of that, the state always assumed and invoked and dominated the idea that I'm the guardian, I'm the father, I'm the provider, I'm the one who tells you what's right and what's wrong. Whether you like it or not, if you are Egyptian, then you're under me, that's end of story. I define what Egypt is, I define what Algeria is. That's no longer true, by the way. If you look at lots of what the Arab media is doing, and by the way, Arab media means TV, sadly, nothing more than that. If you look at what Arab media, whether public or private, and private in the Arab world usually means public as well, you would see that there's now selectivity. I define what being Moroccan is, what being Algerian is today, and if you don't follow these things, if you have a different ideology, then I would not say that you're wrong and I'll put you in prison. I'll do that, but in addition to that, I will say that you're a traitor, that you are really not really Algerian, not really Saudi. That takes the identity point also to an interesting point. I'm trying to move ahead to cover all the points I want to cover. I think with the point of violence I mentioned, numbers vary, but the number I subscribe to, about 500,000 Arabs have been killed, literally killed, in the last 5 years. That's quite a large number. I'm not aware of a single investigation that took place, serious investigation that took place in the Arab world regarding any of these crimes, any of these deaths, let alone the perpetrators were brought to justice. That takes the idea of justice in the Arab world to another law, if you'd like. And if you put that in the context of non-state actors becoming protectors, if you take that in the context of the Arab state being selective, that also sows a very deep hole in the Arab state-society relationship. There is a massive cultural dissent in the Arab world. I'm not going to go into that, but it's extremely important to look at the state of education in the Arab world, media in the Arab world, publishing in the Arab world, art in public sectors of the Arab world. Of course, demographics are usually invoked. Jane mentioned the demographics. Just to give you a sense, I'm 40 years old. When I was born, the Arab world was 180 million people, roughly. Today, it's 330 million people. So in the span of four decades, it increased by, 190 million people. Two-thirds of them are under 30 years old. That's very interesting. But very important, it's not just the demographics. The vast majority of the bright in the Arab world wants to be get out. I'm not talking about the refugees, by the way, that come in, that pay $800 to move from Turkey, from Greece to Turkey, and then from Turkey hoping to find an entry to the European Union. I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about the ones who speak extremely good English, are able to find jobs in the city, and who have some financial means. They want out. And they are getting out. That level of brain drain has always been there, but at these levels, dramatic. And there's also internal immigration. Again, I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but anybody who spent some time in Beirut, in Cairo, in Tunis, in Casablanca, in Riyadh, knows that the bright, whatever the word is in English, they really isolate themselves, whether in terms of jobs, in terms of interaction with society, even in terms of entertainment. Some would even say in terms of identity. There is a very interesting dynamic within how the bright young Arabs are immigrating either out or in. Of course, there's an economic cost. I will not go too much into the extreme sad level of competitiveness in the Arab world. And when you put that next to the demographics, you have probably a not very bright picture. What I'm trying to say, all of these destructive forces make the Arab world today not just the sick man of the region, as the Ottoman Empire used to be described, but basically make it potentially a bomb. And I'm not very politically correct, but I think many people in Western decision-making circles see it that way, that it's basically a bomb. And what can we do to make sure that the bomb does not explode? And if we are not able to prevent the explosion, how can we make the explosion not happen at the same time, but separate small explosions? And if we're not able to do that as well, how can we isolate ourselves from the impacts of the explosion? Now, having put this depressing picture, let me take you through the forces that I think are, I'm hoping at least, would win, which are very different. Right now, probably for the first time ever in the past seven decades, the private sector in the Arab world is the largest employer in every single Arab country with probably two or three exceptions. And one of them is Algeria, but that's a different story. That is new in the Arab world. If you look at the level of SME, small and medium-sized enterprises ownership in the Arab economy right now, I'm not talking about the Arab economy that you read about in The Economist. The Arab economy, including the grey and the black, probably now have exceeded the stage in which the state is the largest contributor of capital and employment. So it's not just private sector. It is not the cronies that have been creating their cash and fortunes in the last 30 or 40 years in the Arab world. It's the second or third or fourth layers beneath that. That's also very new in the Arab world in the last probably six or seven decades. Now, everybody usually, in order to be nice, say something about civil society and nobody understands what the hell is that. But I personally think what really is interesting about civil society right now is not really what you find in labor unions, which are usually state-controlled, or student unions, which are very much observed by the state, but look at very, to me, inspiring episodes taking place right now, for example, in Morocco, the regionalization. Okay, I'm still even 10%. But to move very quickly, so civil society is interesting to look at. Art in the Arab world is very rebellious. The young generation simply lack respect for everything it has inherited, including the elder generation. In my opinion, excellent in the Arab world. Even in religion, I'm not going to go too much into that. In both Arab Christianity and Arab Islam, there is really a revolution going on right now in terms of decision-making within the biggest churches, whether the Maronite or the Orthodox in Egypt, as well as on the tenets of understanding Islam in the Arab world being changed. What I'm trying to say, if you take these sets of forces, then you can argue that despite all of the depressing picture I mentioned initially, there is a bottom-up, not geopolitics, far from geopolitics, it's socio-economic picture that could make the story relatively positive. I'll just end on two points. Usually people ask me after all of that, so what does that mean in terms of policy making in the West? Not much. You have nothing to do, let's be honest. Your resources are extremely limited right now. Your will is extremely limited right now. Your public support for doing anything serious in the Arab world is very limited right now. And to be honest, I'm not particularly sure you really know what to do in the Middle East, because we also don't know as well. So that's a different discussion, what the West can do. But I think it's primarily an Arab story. A final point of disagreement. I'm not particularly sure that whenever Islam slash the Arab world, and they're very different, was in crisis, the response was always rejectionist, like Ibn Taymiyyah or ISIS. In the late 19th century, early 20th century, the response of the huge crisis the Arab world was going through before that was actually very inspiring, in my opinion. One response is very disastrous. And another point of disagreement, I do not think ISIS is realistically described as literalist. It is not literalist in Islam. We can have different views, but literalist is much wider, to my understanding, definition. Wahhabism is literalist, I would agree, but ISIS, I would take that differently. Anyway, I'll shut up. There's still 20 points, but I hope I didn't take too much time.